Welcome to the podcast. This is Who Killed Teresa, and I'm your host, John Allure. For a number of weeks, I've been moonlighting over on a neighbor podcast called Gov Love. Now, Gov Love is a podcast that has to do with issues and interests related to local government. And most recently, I completed an interview with the journalist Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm's known for a number of books, but more recently he himself has launched a podcast called Revisionist History. For this week's episode, I'm going to play that interview with Malcolm Gladwell. And some of you may wonder what an interview with Malcolm Gladwell has to do with a podcast about unsolved murders. Maybe frame it this way. In the interview, we discuss largely issues of social justice, so maybe consider the relationship between criminal and social justice. Malcolm and I attended Trinity College, the University of Toronto, together, and perhaps infamously, we are connected by an episode of The Moth he did in, I believe, 2009, called Her Way, in which he discussed how he and a group of his friends destroyed a wedding. In preparing this interview, I had a number of colleagues review some drafts of it to offer any suggestions they might have for improvement. And overwhelmingly, the common thing that came back was, why did you never discuss the wedding with Malcolm? And at the end of the playing of the interview, I will submit a postscript and offer up my thoughts for why that was never discussed. I think when you hear the whole story, you will probably come to see that it was a justifiable reason. Malcolm Gladwell, welcome.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you, about revisionist history. Nowadays, everyone has a podcast. And then you decided to have a podcast, and I was struck by it. You pack a ton of information into it. It's very emotionally charged, which I like. Initially, what did you set out to do with this podcast? Why did you feel you needed to do it? And are you happy with the outcome?
I have a friend in the podcast business. My old friend Jacob runs Panoply, which is one of the big podcast publishers. And so he just said to me, you should do a podcast. And I was procrastinating about my next book. And so I said, sure. And then I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I just kind of started in the middle. And I had a few stray ideas around of things I thought would be interesting. And then it just kind of mushroomed. I thought it was going to take me, I thought it was going to be a month's work, and it turns out to be 6 months' work. So I was completely deluded on all levels about what I was getting into. But here we are, just finishing season two, and I realized I'm now, it's basically a full-time job. I mean, it's half a year I have to devote to this. So it's turned from this thing I did, entered in very casually, into something that I'm really into.
Yeah, I got to say, it's really great to hear your voice on the, that was sort of an element for people who know you that was missing, from the writing. And then to hear your voice, it just adds a whole new dynamic to it. So you already have one season under your belt of revisionist history, I believe 10 episodes. And I think your season two is premiering this week.
Yeah, new season launches. So we can only do 10. I can only do 10 episodes a year. Coming up with the ideas is a full-time job. So yeah, so the new season airs June 15th, this Thursday, and then every Thursday for the next 10 weeks.
Fantastic. So in thinking of how you said you sort of came into this in the middle of it, if I remember the timing right, I think in the summer of 2015 is when you went on your Twitter rant about the John Paulson, the Harvard $400 million donation. And then I think in December of 2015, Hank Rowan died. Did those two things factor into you wanting to do this, those two events?
No, I had no idea. No, neither of those facts have anything to do, had anything to do with me wanting to. I completely independently decided to do a podcast, never intended to do anything about endowments at all. But then I was going to do just one show on education. It was just going to be that about that kid, Carlos, that I did a show on. And then I did that and I realized that was a show in and of itself. This seems to happen a lot with these podcasts, is I come in with an idea and I realize that the idea is much bigger than I can do in 40 minutes. And so then I did a second show, which was the Vassar versus Bowden show. And then I was going to do the stuff about endowments in that one. And then I realized, oh, no, there's still too much material. And it was only then that I decided to do the... I hadn't known Hank Rowan had died. I just remembered reading somewhere about his years ago about his donation to Vassar State College. So they know the whole thing is incredibly. There's no logic at all. It's just completely serendipitous. But the new season, a big chunk of the last episode I did, which will be episode 6, which is. We're recording this week. I was home in Canada and my sister-in-law told me a story. I was like, really? And then I just took my tape recorder out and I recorded her on the spot. And then the story involved this guy and his wife who lived down the street. And so I called him up and I said, will you come over? And my niece babysitted their kids while this guy and his wife talked to me. I mean, it's literally on that level. Sometimes it's on that level of spontaneous.
Well, yeah, I wondered that. I mean, you're obviously beyond the level where, say, you're at the New Yorker and somebody assigns you to the story. And I wonder how much of that is you, as you say, just serendipitously learning of an event, say, like in the Mennonite episode and just pulling out the tape recorder, as opposed to, somebody assigning you something. I imagine there's not a lot of that, although you get ideas, I imagine, from a lot, they filter through a lot of places.
There's no assignment, sadly. I wish there was. All of the ideas are mine. I'm desperate to find other ways of generating ideas because it's coming up with 10 good story ideas for a podcast is really hard. But no, every single one of them has the same very serendipitous kind of origin. I mean, I have some in the bank, but they're not really. Problem is that, you consider 20 and you choose 10, but you can't just do the 10 remaining the next season because you rejected them for a reason, right?
Right, your ideas move on. Yeah. You're not there anymore.
And they're not. Some of them are not any good. I had one I wanted to do about. I wanted to defend Brian Williams for his memory problems. And I just can't do it in a way that makes me happy. I mean, the desire to defend him is very strong, but the way in which I would defend him just doesn't strike me as being interesting enough. So until I figure out how to do that story, I can't do it. It's sort of not, just having a notion that you're interested in is not sufficient. It's like, is there an interesting way to do it? And I just can't figure out what that is.
I wanted to spend a little time on the education trilogy because I think it's essential listening. Certainly, I have young daughters who are starting the college, experience, and I've insisted that they listen to it. Starting with Carlos doesn't remember. You make the point that. The point of privilege being advised you is second chances. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how that's particularly true in the United States, the idea that you only get one shot, as opposed to, for instance, where we grew up educated in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't, it's very, It's weird. I don't really get it. I don't understand the primacy of college in American mythology. I mean, it's just 4 years, and for those 4 years, people go nuts. They spend 3 years trying to get into the 4-year institution, and then they go into debt for the next 30 years to pay for the 4 years, pay for the 4 years, and then they pretend that something happens in those 4 years that's magical and could only happen at the institution they chose, or at least the institution that was number one on their list. The whole thing is bananas. I mean, it just makes me, there's nothing. I mean, I have this thing rule when I hire assistants, I don't let them tell me the names of any of the institutions they attended. And I tell them, if you let slip where you went to school, you're not getting the job. It's just my little protest against this ludicrous system. I honestly could care less where somebody went to college. Who cares? I care what they can do for me, you know, or what they're like now. I don't know. It's sort of it, the system is there's a number of it's a particular American talent for taking good ideas and destroying them with a kind of an over-application of zeal. You know, the healthcare system in America is too good. It's just ridiculous. I mean, it's like it's so gold-plated, and you know, to the point where nothing matters anymore. You know, there's nothing wrong with playing tackle football. There's a problem with playing tackle football from the age of six, right? Like, it's fine if you play it. In fact, the medical data now backs this up. Your risk of long-term brain trauma, if you start playing in college, is very small. It's just a time thing. The damage you do is the damage you do when you start playing at six. So why play at six? Who needs to play it at six? Like, it's just the same, like, it's this kind of, like I said, this overzealousness that, you know, a good college is a good thing, but that does not mean that the very best college is the very best thing. It's that I'm always reminded of that one wonderful legal axiom, the perfect is the enemy of the good. That to me sums up American society. It's just like that this relentless search for the very, very best thing as if it makes a difference.
It's interesting because, I mean, obviously there are broad themes of social justice I find in all of your work, but particularly in revisionist history. But I always kind of think, is that what you're kind of doing in the podcast? Are you trying to balance the scales a little bit about who wins and who loses? I mean, you talk a little bit about yourself being a lone voice. Do you feel that way?
Well, funny. Now that I have season two in the bag, season two does. I hadn't thought explicitly about that theme, but season two does in more than half of the shows, half of the shows at least, pick up on that. I'm obsessed in season two with power, and with the way in which Americans like to pretend that any complex situation is about anything except a power struggle. So they're always personalizing things. We don't get along, as opposed to he's got all the power and he doesn't, right? That kind of thing, which is, you know, that's the race narrative in this country is, you know, why can't we just get along? Well, why can't we have a system where, you know, one group has the same amount of power as the other group? That's the issue. It's not a personal question. It's not about, you know, so these are things, I guess, as I've gotten older, that I've gotten far more interested in. I don't think I'm a lone voice. I just, because I think there's lots of people who say that. I just think, I think maybe I would only say that there aren't enough voices. Maybe that's it. That you have to shout awfully hard to be heard in this country. So I'd like to be surrounded by 1,000 others saying the same thing. But it, you know, the amount of kind of in this second season, and what I get at a lot is how much euphemism there is in the way Americans describe social problems. And it bothers me that they're not just more honest about it. You know, there's just all this great attempt made to to prettify things. And there's two shows that are just about fairy tales that we've told about civil rights that just aren't plainly, it just didn't happen that way, right? But no one is interested in sort of going back. We're so deeply invested in this very nice little heroic story. And, you know, we've turned our backs on the kind of messiness of real life.
I wanted to follow up a little bit more on Carlos doesn't remember. You talk about the Lenox, California area where Carlos was in middle school. I actually remember that school system. At that time, at a certain point when my daughter was one, we lived in Marina del Rey. Mm-hmm. And so that was going to be an option for her to go to school. And that actually was the catalyst, because you're right in describing it as like a concentration camp. It was one of the main decision points about saying, because my wife at that time was working at this lush school in private school in Pacific Palisades, you know, where Tom Hanks' mm-hmm. kids went and all that. But that's not where our kids were going to go. My kids were going to go to Lenox, and that forced us to make the decision to move to North Carolina, where we'd have a better opportunity. You mentioned...
I had no idea.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had no idea. I had no idea you lived down there. That's funny.
Yeah. You mentioned that, with a lot of these kids, you know, they have to have an intervention, almost in the first 5 years of their lives, because by the time they hit middle school, they're already gang affiliated. Or you said 80% are gang affiliated, which is incredible. How emotionally difficult was it doing that story? I mean, have you heard anything further from Carlos?
Carlos, there was the story I heard was that Carlos was in a summer program. Because he's a really, 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 he's very, very smart kid. And he was doing this enriched summer program on the West Side, you know, at some fancy place. And his teacher made the class listen to that episode. So they all listened to the episode. And then Carlos, of course, his real name isn't Carlos.
Right.
So they don't know it's him. And so he puts his hand up and he says, "That's me." And like the whole class is like, "What?" And he gets up and he talks about it to them. And this was described to me told to me because he had been very reluctant to talk about his family life. And so he got up and I thought that was the kind of, if the episode was not emotional enough, that was the emotional capstone. They're very... some of those they're hard to do. They're not hard to do in the moment. The interview is not the hard part. What the hard part is that sitting and listening to the tape and figuring out what you want to say and then recording it. That's when it sort of hits you. Because in the moment you have your kind of journalist's objectivity protecting you, but you don't when you're just listening to the tape all by yourself.
Can I move to Food Fight?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Okay, first off, I didn't know you worked in the kitchen at Trinity because I lived above it.
Well, I was a tallywhacker. Now, as you will remember, a tallywhacker doesn't technically work in the kitchen. A tallywhacker is an administrator of the kitchen process.
No, it's all coming back to me, unfortunately. Your final conclusion is just suck it up and go to Vassar. You rightly bring up this pressure kids put on themselves about choosing a college and then thinking it's the most four formative years of their lives. I mean, then my middle daughter has so many spreadsheets in this decision-making process of where to apply. And one of the places is Vassar that she's considering. When you did that story, I know you had an intern working on it, but I think who went to Maine, but you went up yourself to the Vassar campus?
I went to Vassar and I sent Jacob, my assistant, to Bowdoin. So and then he went to Vassar on his own to talk to the kids. I did the administration. I'm too old to interview students with any credibility, so I let him do all that. But I did the administration interviews at, it all started because, and I can't remember why, I wasn't intending to do food at all. For some reason, I got it in my head that it would be interesting to talk to the president of Vassar. And so I called her up. It was one of the first interviews I did for the whole season. Called her up, and I went to see her on New Year's Eve. And she was the only person there. Sat in her office, and she just, it's just a super, one of those super interesting interviews that made me think about a million things. But I was originally interested in something else entirely, and I cannot even remember what it was. But I just sort of, it's one of those cases where you just get the, you let the tape run, and then you, she takes you in interesting places. It took a while for me to understand that the episode was about food. Originally, it was just going to be this very straightforward thing about what it means to be a college that like that wants to have a place for lots of poor kids. And then I realized, oh, there's a way more fun way to tell the story, and that is to pick on Bowdoin. Because, you know, Bowdoin is the antithesis of Vassar in this really interesting way. And once I realized I had a villain, and the villain was so wonderfully villainous. I mean, you cannot, can you ask for a better villain than Bowdoin? I mean, you can't, this kind of pretentious, overly wealthy, like, you know, like, little privileged, I mean, it's just like everything, it's just appalling. I mean, it's just like everything about it is horrible. And I knew.
Well, I mean, how much, kind of back push do you get from, say, a Bowdoin or a Princeton?
Tons.
When you do this?
Tons.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God. Bowdoin denounced
and
me.
And did Bowdoin?
They issued press releases. There was like a Twitter war against me. I mean, but remember, that's exactly what I wanted.
Right, to get them to engage.
I realized if I was going to, I mean, I was kind of, I was a little bit calculating. I mean, the episode is over the top, right? I mean, of course. I mean, it's like it was like the kind of thing we would have done back in college. In fact, I was thinking very explicitly of some of our hijinks back in the day. But I was deliberate. I was baiting them, and they took the bait. I mean, like they totally went apeshit. The only thing I didn't do, which I should have done, NPR wanted me to come on one of those afternoon shows and debate someone from Bowdoin. And I really should have done it. I can't believe I didn't do it. I was busy. I had some reason I couldn't do it, but it would have been, I mean, can you imagine how much fun I could have had? I mean, just would have been fantastic.
We should address this. There is that subversive element to the way you do a story that works on that level where you will goad someone like that and then it breaks into, for lack of a better term, a Twitter war. But you're engaging them, and this is, as I recall, this is an old tactic you've had for years. Can you talk a little bit about, you wrote for the student newspaper at Trinity. I believe it was, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it was called The Pelican.
No, and it was called, you're conflating two things. It was called Trinsight. Okay. Trinsight, remember Trinsight?
You're quite right. It was Trinsight.
The Pelican.
And I think you did a. What was the difference?
Pelican Power was a mock football newsletter that I used to post. Remember, in which I would glorify the Trinity football team.
It had absolutely nothing to do with football. Anything you wrote, and yet it did.
Well, Bruce. Remember, Bruce created a character. Since so few people went to the football games, Bruce created this character called Wexford Harding, who we claimed was the football coach. And then Bruce would write these articles by Wexford Harding in the newspaper, in which he would sort of wax elegiac and talk about his drinking problem. And so it was, the whole thing was highly amusing. But yes, no, the provocation, I believe I learned at Trinity from the masters of provocation. And I took those lessons. You know, I feel like there was any number of brilliant role models of how to get someone's goat. And I paid careful attention, and I've kept it up since then. People don't, you know, people's ability to pick fights. People think it's they don't take it seriously enough. There's a real art to picking a fight the right way, to provoking your opponent, and just you can't hit them over the head, and you can't be mean, right? But you can be, you can use the needle. And I always felt like Trinity was at its best. I always think about this moment when there was a college meeting, all the students, and we had a lot of money for some reason because of the video games we had. And right before the meeting, the provost's wife's dog had died because he'd ingested a used condom in the garden of the provost. And someone from St. Mike's College, and for the listeners, St. Mike's College was a Catholic college, which we were, for no real reason, we were formally opposed to the Catholics, right?
Yes, correct. They were
someone
there.
From St. Mike's showed up. They showed up and asked for like literally $100 to go towards a trip to Africa to work with, you know, refugees. And we had this, and everyone instantly in the room saw the comic possibility in a way that even today I don't really understand. We then had this long faux intellectual discussion about, not about the question of whether we should support someone who wanted to help refugees, but whether it was a precedent that we could, whether it was an appropriate precedent for us to be taking discretionary funds and giving it to someone from another college. And everyone loved this totally ridiculous discussion. It went on and on and forever. We had a vote. We voted down the guy from St. Mike's. And then immediately someone puts their hand up and says, I propose that we give the provost $500 for a new dog. And it was approved unanimously. I remember that moment thinking, this is absolutely brilliant. This is how you do it, right? It's hilarious. It's like completely subtle. It's totally outrageous. It so provokes this poor guy from St. Mike's. But there was a kind of collective understanding of how to do the joke. I've just never forgotten. And I remembered that. Well, I have aspired to that kind of cleverness ever since.
Well, and to my mind, that's exactly what's going on when you're interviewing John Hennessy, the president of Stanford, is that you're slowly upping the stakes and saying, how far can I take this? If what would you do with, you know, $10 billion and see if he can respond with a straight face? And he does. You say he says, oh, I could never consider that. And then within 2 seconds, he has an answer.
Yeah. And that was hilarious. Yeah. That was like a gift from God. The whole time that was happening, I was like, I had my eyes on my tape recorder. I was like, dear God, I hope I am recording this. Because if I miss this, man, I've lost an opportunity. Yeah, that was, it's rare that someone takes the bait like that. Yeah, he did.
Did you ever get, to your mind, we should say, Hennessy establishes this Knight Hennessy Scholarship. A hundred of the best and brightest in the country will come to a graduate program at Stanford in order to solve the most important problems, the world's hardest problems. Did you ever get, to your mind, a satisfactory answer as to what those problems were in there, you know, to spend that amount of money?
No, I didn't. I was almost, I mean, he mentioned a couple, but they so clearly were not the world's biggest problems that that the question remains open. He just mentioned the one of trying to figure out why Mark Zuckerberg's gift to Newark wasn't working out the way, which was just another billionaire's, you know, like, so it was like, it seemed awfully kind of, it was a dog chasing its own, it was a billionaire dog chasing its own tail at that point. I didn't. I mean, look, it's not about, they pretend that, but it's ultimately just it's another medal. Or kids with lots of medals. That's what it is. It's an $800 million medal that you give, that you award some winner, in order for that person to say, I'm a winner. And, you know, it's foolish to try and read into it any more than that. That's all it is. You know, it's like, and they needed $1 million to do it. I mean, it was the most lunatic. The minute I heard about that, I was like, this has got to be a joke. I mean, it can't. And it's not. It's like, it's real.
Well, I mean, I certainly watched the video. They have a 4-minute video launching
so
the
good,
scholarship.
Isn't it?
Oh, you know, and it's got
so good.
It's got the drone shots of the campus. It's got Condoleezza Rice. I think innovation is mentioned 6 times. And then they have the nerve to talk about diversity. And what they really mean is geographic diversity. You know, we'll pick this person, this elite person from this country. But as you say, it's absolutely antithetical to what you talk about in the case, Hank Rowan's idea, in order to have a Vassar idea, you have a classroom with true diversity. In that way, the hedge fund manager's daughter learns from, you know, the janitor's son, who are both at the same college. How important was diversity for you growing up in Elmira, or how aware of it were you, or the lack of it?
Well, I was. I mean, it's. I think one of the lessons I learned from growing up in Elmira was, I don't know whether the school environment is necessarily. I mean, I think it was very, very useful for me to go through the end of high school in a community where the overwhelming majority of kids were not going to college and had parents who had not gone to college. I think that was really useful at the end of the day. Apart from, that may be the wrong word to use, but if we're thinking about it in a kind of, what did it mean for me? I think it does ground you in something other than the rarefied world you're going to end up in. So I'm grateful that I went through that experience. And I think as well, especially if you're in the business of, I'm in the mass media business. I write for a wide audience, and it's really hard to learn how to write for a wide audience if you've never spent time with a wide audience, right? So in that sense, I think it beautifully prepared me for what I wanted to end up doing. But more than that, you know, the deeper thing is, I think it wasn't just school. I mean, there's such a focus on school as the primary engine of diversity. But I think the town you live in and the neighborhood you live in is probably even more so. I wonder whether it's part of the same problem we were talking about earlier when we put so much pressure on the school to do everything, and you forget that kids just aren't in school for that many hours, that most of their life is outside of school, and who their neighbor is and who they run into when they go down the street and who they play sports with, those matter to me almost more. I would be, if I thought that people, that kids would meet people different from themselves when they played sports, I would be very happy. I almost feel like that matters more than having a kid who's different from you sitting 2 rows over in math class. You know, doing something active or the kid in your scout troop being different from you. When you're out in the world and engaging with people outside the classroom, those are, I think, much more important lessons.
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. My experience growing up in my neighborhood in Montreal was richly diverse. My experience going to college was not diverse at all, whatsoever.
Yeah.
And at that point, would it have really had an effect?
Yeah. Although, you know, it's funny. My experience at Trinity was very diverse, if only because there was a certain kind of person who I'd never met kind of ruling class kids before. So it was reverse diverse. It was like, you know, these kids, these diplomats kids who went to Upper Canada College or whatever, or what's the one in What's the one in Ottawa, the fancy one, or in Montreal?
I know that. Well, if they went to Brébeuf school, the private school in Montreal.
Yeah.
And you're right. So there you are at Trinity, and you're rubbing, you know, shoulders with the son of the former Bank of Canada. And you're kind of going, what?
That's interesting. You know, that I find that totally fascinating. I did not know anyone like that. And I didn't know. I remember telling my dad, I can't believe I said to him, I went home to my father and I said, you know, of all of the fathers of the kids on my floor, you make the least money. He took it. I didn't mean it in a horrible way. I was just pointing out to him. It's like, what I meant was, this is a weird place that I'm going to college. Like, you're a college professor and I'm the poorest family on my floor. And he, of course, maybe I think I offended him deeply, but it's true. I mean, it's weird. I, when I was in high school, my father would have been, you know, one of the very wealthiest people in high school. And then in college, I basically did the math in my head and was like, you know, I don't think he's anywhere near the top.
I've read that as a child, you'd kind of have the run of your father's of the campus at University of Waterloo, being able to kind of float through there freely and explore. And is that true? Is there and did that have an effect on you?
It might be a slight exaggeration. I used to go with him. My fondest memories of childhood are when I would go with my father. I would skip school, go with him to the university, and spend the day in the library, the university, which I just thought was the greatest thing in the world, and still do. There was a kind of, by virtue of having parents who are, you know, intellectually minded, you just get access to a world. I mean, we did two things. We read a lot of books and we traveled. And my parents had friends who read a lot of books and traveled. And, you know, that was an incredible luxury. I think of my upbringing as being extraordinarily privileged. I mean, I can't imagine it being any better.
Shall we talk a little bit about Deportees Club?
Yes, let's do that.
So this is your episode where you kind of talk about the difference between an artist who's sort of like a one-off, a one-and-done, say like an Orson Welles. He makes Citizen Kane, that's it. As opposed to, in this case, what you use, I guess, is Elvis Costello's song Deportees Club, and then further on, Leonard Cohen's Alleluia, which were really long iterative processes to get to a final positive outcome. But beyond all that egg-headedness, let's just say that Deportees Club is one of the worst songs you've ever heard. I've ever heard, definitely.
Yeah, it's a terrible song.
I remember the summer that album came out, Goodbye Cruel World, because it was coming off the heels of which one it was, maybe Imperial Bedroom, an album that was so good. And so there was a great sense
Punch,
of
isn't
anticipation.
It after Punch the Clock? It's after Punch the Clock, I think.
It is, right.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Maybe not so much Elvis Costello, but that episode and what led to it?
Yeah, I wanted to do, I can't remember what came first. I just ran across this great book that had been written about Alleluia. I read it, and then the guy was in New York, so I just met with the author. And I was just really taken by, I've always been fascinated by this notion of the slow developing hit. And I hadn't realized that song had such an extraordinarily long lead up. I think originally it was just going to be a song, a piece about Alleluia. But what I realized with these podcasts is that they're always better when there's a B story. And if the B story is personal, if one of the two stories is personal, it works even, the absolutely perfect podcast from for revisionist history in my mind is two stories that overlap but are not the same. One is personal, one is not. One has a kind of deeper theme, and you toggle back and forth between the two of them. That's the kind of format that I think is ideal. And so I just got to thinking about Deep Ortiz Club when I was reading about Alleluia, just because I know why. Because I bought a turntable, and someone as a gift gave me Goodbye Cruel World, and I listened to it, but I listened to it like for the, that was one Elvis Costello album I never bought. And I listened to it and realized that I hadn't realized that he had done a original version of Deep Ortiz called Deep Ortiz Club. Heard it for the first time when I was just by accident, when I was in the middle of doing the story, and thought, oh my God, first of all, that's terrible. And secondly, exactly what I'm talking about with Alleluia. So it was another one of these serendipitous, I literally had completely, for some reason I just thought that Deep Ortiz Club Deep Ortiz was a B-side he just threw out there and never put on an album. I had no idea it had an origin as a song that had been released in a different form. And so, yeah, it was just a kind of, and when I realized that, I was like, oh, you know, it's better. That's just more interesting to have Elvis Costello side by side with, and then I spent months fruitlessly trying to talk to Elvis Costello and failed. So then I decided I would make do with, which has actually turned out very well with his producer.
Did you go to London for that interview?
Yeah, I did. I was in London. I did a bunch because there's a bunch of London interviews in the first season. I just did them all in one go. I loved the producer. I just thought he was fantastic. And such a London character. I mean, you know, there we were in Hackney, you know, like, of course, in a pub in Hackney. I mean, you just can't. Like, there's something so fantastic about the English that I can't ever get enough of. And that was part of it.
I wondered if you could preview the new season of Revisionist History. What should people be looking forward to?
It is very happy with it. I think it's better than season one. It's a little more, I know a little more what I'm doing now. I have four civil rights episodes, four shows that basically are all about the 50s in the South. I unearthed some really weird, creepy stuff. And then I have a really fun piece about sad songs, country music and sad songs. I have a piece about how McDonald's ruined French fries. I have a spy story. I have this thing about World War II, about the Bengal famine of 1943, who caused it. You know, it's like same old, it's like it jumps all over the place. I got one on golf. The opening one is about golf. The title is Good Walk Spoiled, Rich People in Golf, A Philosophical Investigation. It's all about, it is exactly that, a philosophical investigation of why rich people are obsessed with golf. And I enlist at the end an actual real live philosopher, and we get into it. It's a really fun episode. That's what opens it up. I'm very excited about it.
Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I want to end with something called a lightning round. It's just for people to get to know a guest a little better. So I'll just take you through a bunch of questions here.
All right.
Malcolm Gladwell, what book are you currently reading?
I'm currently reading an old Len Deighton thriller called Funeral in Berlin.
Really? I wouldn't have thought that at all. what are two things on your LinkedIn profile that we might not actually know about you? Are you even on LinkedIn? I have no idea.
No, I'm not. Okay. I mean, I am. But there's no substance to it, so I wouldn't even know what I have on it.
All right. I'll reframe the question. What are two things we might not know about you?
I'm an obsessive track and field fan. That's one. What's another?
Well, car enthusiast.
Yes. And a massive car enthusiast. Yes, I have, for example, back issues of every issue of Car magazine, which is the great car magazine. It's called Car, going back to the early 90s. That's how
I had no idea. As a kid, you sent away for all those brochures, right?
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Because I'm a car nut. I continue to be. I have not changed in that respect.
What's the first concert you ever saw?
The Good Brothers. The Good Brothers were a Southern Ontario bluegrass band who I saw in 1977.
Oh, boy. Then what was the second concert?
Might have been the Mercy Brothers, who were a Southern Ontario country band. a very good one, actually. They were from Elmira.
Okay.
They did a very good version of Old Loves Never Die. They just fade away. The third concert I saw was a Bruce Springsteen concert, I believe. So,
what was your favorite cartoon growing up?
Doonesbury.
A show you like to binge watch?
The OA.
What's
on
that?
Netflix. The OA.
Oh, The OA, yes.
It was done by two friends of mine. I love that show.
When you're in Toronto, where do you like to go to lunch?
Good question. Toronto for lunch always slightly baffles me. I'm boring. Either Queen Street West Corridor, or even better, the neighborhood I really like is High Park. On Roncesvalles. Pick someplace on Roncesvalles and have lunch.
Well, hey, Malcolm, I really appreciate you taking your time this afternoon to have a talk, and I wish you a great day.
Thank you, John. And so, thank you. And I will, I won't be able to do this right away, but I will, by the end of the day, I'll send you the file.
So here's the thing about the wedding, and if you haven't even heard The Moth yet, here's what I suggest you do. Go and Google Gladwell, The Moth, Her Way. Pause this, go do that, listen, it'll take you all 15 minutes, and then come back and we'll talk about Her Way. So everything in Malcolm's story, Her Way, is true, with a few changes. A couple of names were changed for obvious reasons, although not very protectively. He pretty much let slip who Craig is at one point. And the wedding wasn't in Arizona. The wedding was in San Diego, California. It was along a highway. All I remember was like the 405, a lot of concrete, a hotel downtown San Diego, a whole lot of concrete. The reception wasn't at some steakhouse. The reception was at the Coronado Hotel in San Diego. And all of that, all of it, though, is absolutely true. We did do at a rehearsal dinner, I did. That's me, who read out the list of names with the script pouring out of my pocket. There's so many women's names and all of that. I do remember having some momentary regrets, potential of. Should we really go on with this the next day? Because we were already planning. I think we had already written a couple of verses or at least knew we were going to sing a song the next day at the wedding. What else do I remember? Dick, the defense contractor, father of the bride, was he kind of looked, you know, he kind of looked like L. E. Yost. If I think everybody nowadays knows the producer Graham Yost, who, among other things, produces The Americans on FX. Graham Yost's father was a guy named L. E. Yost, who had a TV show on, I think it was Saturday evenings. It was the Saturday afternoon movie in Ontario, and that was L. E. Yost. And Dick looked very much like L. E. Yost. I remember there was a wedding cake there. It was this three-tiered affair on plexiglass. You know, it kind of looked like from the Jetsons, with each tier of plexiglass being like a different, you know, world within Jetson's world. And I think at some point later in the evening, I face planted the cake. I think that did happen. A lot of ponytailed boys serving chicken satay. And yeah, the whole thing just got completely out of hand. I ended that evening upstairs on the rooftop by the pool in the jacuzzi, naked in the jacuzzi with a bottle of champagne. And Malcolm walked by and saw me and said, "Allure, you mad genius," and tore off all his clothes and joined me in the jacuzzi. So this was the kind of affair that we thought it should be, and that it devolved into. And then, of course, the next day, we ruined a friendship and a wedding. And just to prove that I am the John, Malcolm's moth story. Malcolm mentioned the song Big and Goofy, done to the tune of Feeling Groovy. But then he said he didn't remember the further verses. Well, I remember them, and the final verse went like this. "There's no trick I won't turn, there's no promise I'll keep. I'm stupid and boring, I'll put you to sleep. Keep integrity right the feck out of my life. Boom, boom. I am a clod who's big and goofy." So the question should always be, did we learn the lessons of that fiasco? Did we ever get smarter in these affairs? And I would say yes, but with the caveat that going forward, always there were a couple of variables missing from this toxic mix. So years later, I would go to other weddings, but you felt that the groom or whoever you were being there, you were representing there as a friend in that capacity, if you had an inappropriate toast or remark, you felt they might take it better than potentially Craig did. That was the first thing. The second element that was always missing from future weddings was a lot of the players from that Her Way San Diego wedding in the future weddings were there, but not all of them. And certainly not Malcolm. And there was always with Malcolm there a danger, a potential. Malcolm was like this enabler. He was like a gateway drug. Certainly when he and I got together, a danger that things could get gravely out of hand. So cut forward 20 years, and by this time it's already been, I believe, like maybe 2 or 3 years since Malcolm has done this story on the moth, and we both get invited to a wedding in New York. And if I recollect it correctly, Bryce was Malcolm's childhood best friend, and he was my college best friend. So we had this connection, and Bryce was not someone who you did not want to screw up his wedding by any token. We were older at this point. We were supposed to be wiser, and although instruction wasn't given to us, it was known by several parties for that wedding weekend what had happened and who had done it, and there was a sense of foreboding surrounding the affair that something potentially could go horribly wrong that you had over which you had no control. And this started very early. I remember, I think one of the first events was drinks at a bar in Brooklyn, and I entered the room, and many familiar faces there, and then I looked across the room, and there was Malcolm. And my first reaction was, oh my God, don't look him in the eye, because it's going to be like a virus. If you guys get out of control, there's going to be no stopping you, and you won't even know when it's happening. It will start with a few words in conversation, and then it will quickly escalate and devolve until it's too late and there's no turning back. So there was just this intense sense of foreboding, and whatever you do, you need to be like hyper conscious of your behavior, because you can't screw it up. And I don't even think I exchanged but two words with Malcolm that entire weekend, nor he with me, because we were so hyper aware that we could catch this infection, this virus that would prove once again that we were not smart enough to screw up the most important day of someone's life. Next day, we're wedding at the chapel, and followed by a reception, I believe, at the Botanical Gardens in Brooklyn. And again, the situation was sort of repeated, and you never knew what might throw things. It's like, should you have ordered that San Pellegrino instead of a bourbon? Would you potentially say something inappropriate? Would you laugh inappropriately at a toast that everyone would just go, oh God, here it goes again? there was a moment of worry that Bryce was also a journalist, and so there were a lot of people, slightly famous people who attended this, who I knew who they were, but I didn't know them. And David Carr from the late David Carr from the New York Times was there. Brian Steltler was there. I believe Sam Sifton from the Times, the food critic, might have been there. There was some famous food critic there. And at one point, after dinner, I got cornered by a bunch of them. And it was Carr who was sort of leading it, and he started in. He was like, "So, you're the John from the wedding, right?" And I'm like, "Oh my God, this!" And so I'm trying to, I'm like, "Yeah, I am." Did it really happen? Was that true? So I'm trying to be really, like a biographer, telling him factually what happened without enjoying any of it, because I figure if I start enjoying it, they'll start enjoying it, and then again, the virus will catch us and someone will do something wrong. And Malcolm, again, wisely wasn't around. We avoided each other all night. But in the end, I'll say this: we behaved ourselves. And we proved that we could be smart, and that we could just go to an event like this, finally 20 years later, and not say a thing and not steal focus and simply have a good time, because that's what your hosts wanted you to do, to participate in the dance without monopolizing the dance in any way. And at the end of it, the final thing was Malcolm was asked to give a toast. And of course, there was a little, again, this was provoking the situation, because although you imagined that Bryce had spoken to him, you didn't quite know what potentially, again, could happen. But Malcolm gave one of the most remarkable wedding toasts to friendship that I have ever heard. It was eloquent. It was urbane. It was humorous, and it was completely sincere. So that is my wedding story. We did it his way. This has been Who Killed Teresa, and I'm your host, John Allure. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a comment on iTunes. And please leave Malcolm a comment on iTunes as well. His podcast, Revisionist History, is available there. And we are now approaching episode 2 of season 2. Have a listen. Check it out. It's good stuff. Finally, you can follow me on Twitter at Justice Guy. That's at JUSTUSGUY. Now